I would like to introduce you to what has become a very important aspect of the study of the Bible today, namely biblical archaeology. I'm sure that you all have heard in one way or another of it. I would like to discuss more broadly today, in 10-15 minutes, what biblical archaeology is all about, but then I would like to become very tangible and concrete, but more about this in 10-15 minutes. 2-3 generations ago, if you had asked someone what archaeology is, biblical archaeology for that matter, probably that person would have had to confess that it is more like a treasure hunt. That is the way in which biblical archaeology began, even with Schliemann digging up ancient Troy. And the trophies were brought home to Europe or to North America and deposited there in the great museums. In Chicago, where I teach, we have a very beautiful example of it in the museums of the Art Institute, of the Field Museum, and of the Oriental Institute. However, this has changed. Today, archaeologists can no more take home in triumph, as it were, what they have found. More often than not, what they found are very humble finds. This is especially true of Palestine, of the land of Canaan, because it has always been a backwater. The people who lived there, very humble people. And you can probably recall from the Old Testament and the New Testament many passages that say that the people of the Lord, measured by worldly standards, were a very humble lot indeed. And this is also reflected in what biblical archaeologists find. No great treasures. I recall in 1968, 10 years ago, when I dug at biblical Shechem, we once found a golden ear pendant. Evidently, it had once belonged to a girl. Well, we were pleased, of course, to have found such a little treasure, wondered what little girl had gotten fits for losing it. Most of us were parents, evidently. But these were exceptions. On the whole, the material remains from the land of Canaan, from the land of the Bible, are very humble ones indeed. Furthermore, today, archaeology is no more a treasure hunt in that sense. We are not allowed to take out of the host country any of the things we find. To be more exact, about 2 years after each campaign is over, a representative of the host government will come and make, quote, quote, the division and take the best objects that have been found, and they will then be deposited in the museums or even be exhibited. The rest, the sponsoring institutions, may take home. It is, however, the understanding that whatever has been found is to be made available for scholarly study as soon as possible, namely through photography and scholarly publication. And on the whole, the archaeologists, both those of the host countries, but also those coming from Europe, America, or even Japan, keep their promise and publish as soon as possible. So it is no more a treasure hunt. What then is it? Well, I can give you a fancy definition of biblical archaeology, and I can give you also one that's somewhat more down to earth. Let me give you the fancy one first. It is the attempt to reconstruct the material culture of an ancient site or an ancient region. Let me repeat. It is the attempt to reconstruct the material culture of an ancient site or an ancient region. First of all, we usually deal with a given site, an ancient city, or an ancient trade center, or an ancient port, or an ancient library, or an ancient palace, or an ancient shrine. And we deal now more and more with regions, aware of the fact that our material civilization usually is embedded into the context of a region. For instance, if you were to study Evanston, the city where I live, a suburb of Chicago, you would probably not get very far understanding Evanston unless you saw it in its Chicago context, in terms of the Chicago region. Life normally, social life, moves within the context of a region. Therefore, we have shifted today from an emphasis on a site, even though certain small areas are still being dug, to an emphasis that is called regional. In fact, the seminary where I teach, we have a research institute that has made one of its aim the study of regions, not just individual sites. The region that we have chosen and where we cooperate with other institutions, both here in North America, Duke University, and abroad, namely in Israel, is the region of Galilee. And in due time, I will tell you a little bit more about our study of the region of Galilee. So it deals with an ancient site, say Jericho or Shechem, or if you go further afield from the land of Canaan, with one of the pyramids of Egypt or one of the temple towers of ancient Mesopotamia. It deals with a site and a region. Secondly, it is concerned with the material culture or the material civilization. That means we are not concerned primarily at this point with what the ancients said, what they wrote, what they thought, what they believed, because for that we get very little evidence in what we find, unless, and then archaeologists are very happy, they strike it rich and run into an ancient library, a temple library, a palace library, or more often than not, a combination of the two. That has happened. Recently, you have probably heard of a spectacular find of this kind in the ancient city of Ebla, E-B-L-A, or sometimes also spelled I-B-L-A. I have to confess, I'm missing a blackboard, and I have to chase up a blackboard. I'm a real schoolmaster who cannot exist without a blackboard. At any rate, at this ancient site of Ebla, barely known to us from ancient Near Eastern texts, Italian archaeologists have since 1976 struck it rich. In this huge ancient site, now of course completely ruined and covered over by sand and grass, in Syria, about 150 miles north of the land of Israel, they found a library in which so far 16,000 tablets have turned up. 85% of these texts are economic texts, tax lists. In other words, taxes already then. And they come from the years 2450 to 2200 BCE. In other words, more than 4,000 years ago. Now, the other 15% of these tablets found at Ebla, and our scholars are just beginning to decipher them and to translate them, throw a flood of light onto the culture of Syria in the third millennium BCE. And most Old Testament scholars are also talking about the great finds at Ebla. Whenever we get together for scholarly meetings, that is sure to be one of the topics. But to go closer to home, you have probably heard of the famous Dead Sea Scrolls. That is another such find, where we encounter the ancients writing and thinking and in fact talking to us. Now I intend maybe next week to have a session in my chalet in the afternoon where we will read a few sections from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you will find in the bookstore the good, simple paperback edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I would like to commend to you. But friends, in Palestine proper, so far we have not run into any tablets or ancient writings, except for the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are somewhat marginal for reasons that I can explain some other time. In fact, if you were to total up all the written remains that have turned up from Palestine, it would not amount much more than, in quantity, 2 pages of the Bible. So very little has been found that tells us something about what the ancients thought, how they believed, how they prayed, how they wrote. That we still get from the Bible. And therefore, of course, the Bible remains the most basic document, the most basic text to study. To return, we deal with the material culture. That means how the ancients actually lived. How they built their houses. How they made their living. What they ate. What clothes they wore. What they planted. What kind of animals they raised. What trade routes they had, how money, or its equivalent, flowed back and forth, but also how they laid out their important buildings, such as palaces or temples. All this is part of the material culture.
We're
going
to get fossils.
And you know what? It has chalk with it.
Here,
no,
this will work fine.
That will work. Well, maybe the eraser is a hint that I shouldn't fill the blackboard more than once. Now, this ancient city of which I spoke, Ibla, or also spelled with an E here, is found in Syria. The time, according to the latest estimations, 2450 to 2200 BCE. You will probably hear more of it. I'm writing it down only for your information. Or I mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls, usually abbreviated DSS, of which more next week. But let me return to the material culture.
Excuse me, may I interrupt?
Yes, by all means ask questions.
There are several of us here shaking our heads and wondering what the D is at the end of the BC.
Oh, yes. That is, I teach at a seminary that is at the same time a graduate school of a secular university. Some of our graduate students are Jews. Therefore, we have to choose neutral designations for the time periods. BC means before Christ. AD is a Latin phrase and means in the year of our Lord. Now that's fine within the Christian realm, and certainly we use it there. We usually use BCE, before the common era, and CE, common era. It is identical with BC and AD. Good question. Yes. And let me encourage you to raise your hand and to come forth with questions. I'm pleased to answer them. All right. Now, putting together what this material culture was like, reconstructing it, is a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle. In fact, you might say a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, because we deal with various levels or ages. See, this is the way it worked. Long ago, say 3,000-4,000 years ago, when nomadic people began to filter into land that could be settled, where agriculture could be carried on, they had to move to settlements like villages. Now that went gradually. They would select a site that, first of all, had water readily available. That's still so today. Take away the waterworks and we can't live 2 days. Secondly, a site that had supporting land around it to carry on agriculture or sheep breeding or what have you. And thirdly, preferably, a site that could be easily defended against intruders. So these wandering nomads, ready for gradual settlement, would find a fertile plain where water was available and where there was already a natural hillock. They would choose this for their site, and they would build a city. Now this is a somewhat schematic description of what happened, but roughly that's the way it went. So you had here the ground, the grown soil, and this is the way in which we usually indicate that this is so. Then here you had a natural well and water supply. And let us say here the ground was a little bit raised so that it would be a natural place to defend. They would build their city on top of it and would live there 1 generation, 5 generations, 20 generations. I do not know. Then maybe the plague would come through. All the people would die out. And after 50 years, whatever there was on that hill, whatever there once was, would have fallen down, erosion would have leveled it, the wind would have brought in sand, and grass would grow over it. Say 200, 300, 400 years later, another group would come and say, this is a good place to settle. And so the story would repeat itself, you see. And so you have then gradually a build-up of strata. Strata is a technical term from the Latin, which means layers that build up one after another. Maybe the new group that comes might find out that there was a settlement before, and then they would eagerly dig for the building materials they might find. Very common feature, robbing out earlier layers, we call it. And that is law number one of practical archaeology. People will always do things the laziest way possible. So why go far afield for building material? It's just digging half a foot or maybe 2 feet, you can find it. But at any rate, so one layer would build up after another. One occupation might come to an end through the plague, another one through war, another one through famine or change of economic conditions. But what you will have left behind is what we call with an Arabic word a tell, T-E-L-L, sometimes spelled with two L. And it means that kind of a hillock that is not naturally grown, but rather represents the successive deposits of occupations on that site. Jericho, for instance, has close to 30 such layers. Mm-hmm. And archaeologists who have made a probe into it, dug into it, you never dig the whole site, for one thing, we don't have the time or the money. And furthermore, we wouldn't leave anything for future generations to check the accuracy of our work. So we dig probe trenches, and those at Jericho go down 40, 50 feet. Mm-hmm. So much so that we now have to set up elaborate security measures that visitors don't fall into the trenches and kill themselves. Go to Jericho and you will find it confirmed. Sometimes the hillock is only a few feet high, sometimes 20, 30. It all depends. And you may have one or two or 10 or 20 occupation layers. And what the archaeologist does is he or she, so to speak, cuts into that layer cake and tries to determine how many layers there were, how many occupations. Then secondly, when they are to be pegged time-wise, what century this occupation, what century that occupation. And so, remember the three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, gradually piece the history of that site together with reference to its material culture. Now that is basically what archaeologists do, and this brings me now to the more concrete part of my presentation. What clues do they have? What indicators do they have in order to tell with what period they are dealing? Let me give you an example and you can give me the answer. Take our tell here. And let us say I am the archaeologist in charge of the probe trench, usually 2 meters by 2 meters. Archaeologists work with the decimal system, not this outdated system we still retain here in the United States. Let us say we have dug in here. And I observe, and this is in fact what happened to me last summer when I dug a house from the 4th century of our era, for about 75 centimeters, the soil is black, lots of remains of decomposed plants, lots of glazed pieces of pottery, and coins that have Turkish and Mameluk inscriptions on it. Well, now, I've given it away. Coins with Turkish and Mameluk inscriptions evidently come from the last several hundred years, never mind pegging it exactly. And that the pottery fragments are glazed means it comes from the Arab period. All right. Then I come into a layer that looks different and feels different and smells differently. Archaeologists use all their senses, by the way. And here I find a little lamp fragment that has a Crusader's cross on it. And I find a coin minted in France in 1145. Well, you can be quite sure I have struck the Crusader layer, right? And so I can move down and down. Some periods may be altogether missing. Well, the site was not occupied during that period. But through the indicators which I find, usually coins to approximately the 3rd or 4th century BCE are the best indicators of the period to which that particular layer belongs, for obvious reasons. The other way of telling to what period a particular layer belongs is to, quote-quote, read the pottery. You see, pottery was the most common implement. Pots were made from it. That was what was commonly available to everybody. And furthermore, when pottery is fired, it is pretty well indestructible. Of course, you can break a pot. All the better. You let the shards, the pieces fall where they may, and you don't bother picking them up. But this means they are left for the archaeologist to be picked up and to be read. If you were to go into your grandmother's attic, let's say something like this exists, and you run into an old trunk where she has put down her stuff, you might find at the top layer some pottery, or let's say rather ceramics or cups, that are typical for the youth style of the 20s, and you would probably be able to identify it. You would remove all this, and you would get further down to a few old cups that she evidently treasured that are clearly of Victorian style. You could tell the two apart.
And you could probably say grandmother used that trunk in order to deposit whatever cups or other trinkets from the Victorian period she didn't want anymore, but didn't want to throw away, and put them down in the bottom of the trunk. And then later she had another load at the end of the 20s, when a new style came in, maybe, and she put in all the stuff from the 20s in there. And you could deduce, as a proper archaeologist, that grandmother used this trunk in two periods to deposit whatever she didn't want at the end of each period. That's the way we also work with pottery. Now, at first, when I was introduced to pottery reading in 1968 at Shechem, when I worked there with the Drew McCormick expedition, it looked to me like reading tea leaves. How could these people all know from what different periods these little fragments of pottery came? Because you rarely find a whole piece. But, friends, what we collect when we dig are what we call the indicator sherds. Pieces from the rim, from the base, or from the handle. Not body sherds. They don't tell us very much. They're nondescript. And if you give me, for instance, only the 24th part of that rim, that low down, I can pretty well reconstruct this vessel, its diameter, the kind of rim, how it stood, you see, whether the rim was curved in or curved out. I could not tell you how high the vessel stood, but I could tell you 75% of the vessel. And that's enough for me already, or for the real specialists in pottery reading, to tell from what period a certain piece of pottery comes. And then, indirectly, date the layer from which it comes. Now, this is the principle. In practice, as always, things are much more difficult. You see, sometimes the lines between the layers are not clear. Sometimes a later generation has dug a pit in order to bury garbage or to store grain. And so you have to deal with the pit first. You have to clean it out completely. Now, I remember in 68 at Shechem, one of my fellow archaeologists, who teaches at one of the Lutheran colleges on the East Coast, was very disgusted. He had a promising late bronze site, and it was pockmarked with pits. So he had to clean out all the pits first, because if he doesn't do that, he contaminates his actual digging. We called him the pit specialist. So it isn't always quite that simple, especially when war goes across the site and things are churned upside down, sometimes to the point that archaeologists decide that it is not worth digging a site. For instance, the ancient site of Akko, and the northern end of the state of Israel, it has not really been dug. A probe trench has been laid into it, but one of the Israeli archaeologists told us, I would be a fool if I dug that site. I know from the Bible, from ancient Near Eastern writings, from the Greek historians, and many other sources, that this city has been conquered more than 100 times. Well, that's just as good as putting it all into a huge mixer, like you have in the kitchen, and everything is turned upside down. So these considerations are in the picture too. Now let me show you a representative pottery collection that relates only to one implement of ancient culture, namely the lamp. What I have brought along to show to you today is my collection of ancient lamps. Now, of course, you know that the lamp is referred to many a times in the Old and the New Testament, that it was the basic implement to provide light, even though, remember, the ancients lived with the sun, and you can count in Israel with at least 11 and a half hours of daylight, no matter when. In the winter, you see, the variation between the length of day and night is not as great as with us here further in the north. And the little lamps that they used could be put under a bushel, you remember, or the oil supply in it could run out. Remember the parable of the foolish and the wise virgins? Was a little, very little thing. It was more like a flashlight in function. 1 watt at best. It was fired with third grade olive oil and a wick that was curled into it and stuck out through a snout, which then burned like a candle. And more, I think you will be able to see once I have spread this out here for you. Now, I have here 8, 9 lamps. The oldest one comes from the Middle Bronze Age. Let me not go into the names for the different periods, why they are called that. Let me simply identify the Middle Bronze Age, MB, in our abbreviation system, from approximately 2200
to approximately 1600 BCE. All of these dates are approximate only. Now that would be the time of Abraham and the patriarchs mentioned in the book of Genesis. Then I have a land from the late Bronze Age that stretched for approximately 400 years, and that would be, in terms of the Bible, roughly the time of Moses and Joshua. Then I have a land from the early Iron Age, which we call Iron One, which in the land of Israel is dated to these 200 years, from approximately 1200 to 1000 BCE. In terms of biblical history, that's the period of the judges. King David came to be king approximately at that time. Then I have a land from the Iron II period. That is from approximately 1000 BC down to the Babylonian exile. That is the time of the prophets of ancient Israel, of Elijah and Elisha, Isaiah and Amos and Jeremiah. Then I have a land from the Hellenistic time. That is the time of Alexander and what followed the 200 years, approximately from 333 to 63 BCE. I have chosen this date because it is the date when the Romans appeared in Palestine. Then I have a lamp, in fact two, from the Roman period. I have two lamps from the Roman period, and the Roman period we date from 63 BCE in Palestine up to, convenient, let's say, the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE. I have a Jewish lamp and a Christian lamp. In fact, I should make that a three, and then one that is earlier but still Roman. And then I have, finally, a Byzantine lamp. That is from the time after Constantine, 325 to approximately 640 CE. 640 because then Islam appeared in Palestine and began an altogether new era. And then finally I have a modern Arab land. Now, so much by way of preview. Let me now show these lamps to you, and you are welcome to come up here after the session and inspect them. Or is there another class right here?
Yeah.
Then we have to hurry. The oldest one is this. This is the one from the Middle Bronze Age. This is a beautiful specimen that was never used. There are no soot remains here. Now, all these lamps, or let's put it this way, the first four are wheel-turned. An early bronze lamp, which I could have bought for $50, which I didn't have, is not wheel-turned. In fact, the introduction of the wheel in that respect marks the transition from EB, early bronze, to middle bronze. They are all wheel-turned, and you see they are very simple design. After it has been turned on the wheel, the potter would simply pinch it like this, and you would have the snout. Now, functionally, the oil would be filled in here, and then a wick curled several times, then pulled out through the snout, and then it would burn like a candle. Mind you would have to trim the wick from time to time, like the old kerosene lamps. With a candle, of course, we don't need to do that, because it naturally burns down and is self-trimming, you see. And it would burn with a normal supply that would go up to the rim for maybe 2 hours, and that would be all. It would be used in the evening for some chores that didn't get done during daylight, but it would not burn continually. The fire was kept in the hearth, you see, not in the lamp. It was put on a ledge, and there it stood and burned. That is the earliest specimen I have. Middle bronze, approximately 2200 following. Now let me go to the late bronze lamp, which you see in design is very similar to it. This one has been repaired. Bedouins who found it, quote, quote, namely got it out of a tomb in which it was deposited with the one who was so buried. Archaeologists rarely find big, beautiful pieces like this. We find just little rims, you see, and that's fine. They have repaired it here, and I think they have also added a little bit of black paint here to suggest that it has been used. That's fine. It is, whatever is there of the old lamp is genuine. I'm quite assured of this, and furthermore, I need it for teaching purposes, not as an investment, you see. You can study this too, but you see the design is not very different from the other one. that there is a difference in size doesn't matter. We have found them in all sizes, but usually made of clay. Occasionally in palaces, you find them made of metal. Then they are more valuable. Yes, please.
Now, how do you know the difference between those two?
Yeah, now that is a very fine point. It has something to do with the way in which it sits. This one is more level than this one. You see the tilt backwards? That's typical for LB. Now, mind you, this is, the identification is made on the basis of a long experience of working with these things. And you can understand how at first to me it seemed like reading tea leaves, and I asked exactly the question you have asked. With the Iron Age, the firing becomes harder. They were then able to produce higher temperatures, which also, by the way, meant that they could move to iron working. Here you have a lamp, let's say, from the time of David, which again, you see, in design is like the others, but when you inspect it more closely, you can see that it is burnt, fired, to a harder. That has a slightly different sound from this one. That doesn't work in this case, but I've seen some archaeologists who would even chew fragments in order to determine the grit content. I haven't proceeded or advanced to those heights of insight. And this lamp here, easily the heaviest one, it comes from the Iron II period. Now here you can see a change taking place. This one from the age of the judges or King David has no base. It's rounded, yes? While this one has a base, you see it? Furthermore, while with the Iron I lamp, you have the rim beginning to be formed in its own right. You can barely make it out. You have with the Iron II lamp, the rim bent over like this. That's very typical. Now, do not ask me why they made these changes. That is style, and you know that that happens today too, and it may have to do a lot with the human desire to have something new. Now, the next lamp I want to show you comes from the Hellenistic period, and see how it is different. Now that it is smaller, that's not so important, but its design is altogether different. This is, so my pottery, my wife who knows pottery tells me, made in two molds, upper half and lower half, then finished on the wheel and the spout put onto it. But anyone who knows a little bit about pottery from the ancient period knows that this is a Greek design. This is the Hellenistic culture permeating the whole then known world. And those of you who have studied history know that commonly with Alexander, we even let a new period, a new civilization in Toynbee's terms, begin. And that is well reflected also in this change that takes place. This is a different kind of lamp. It also is decorated. You can see these lines here.
What period was between the Second Iron and the Hellenistic?
That there was the Persian period from 538-37 to 333. The Persian period is very poorly represented in the land of Canaan. I could not buy a lamp. The seminary, though, owns one. But thou shalt not covet thy seminary's lamp. The next lamp comes from the Roman period, where I have actually three. Now this is actually called a Herodian lamp. Herodian is a sub-period of the Roman period. It is the time when the Herodians ruled in Palestine. It is the kind of lamp that Jesus knew. It is the kind of lamp you have to think of when you read the parable of the foolish and wise virgins, or the various lamp sayings that you get in the Sermon on the Mount and other saying sources and passages in the New Testament. The lamp that can be put under a meal tub, so the translation of the New English Bible, or a lamp that is put high up on a stand that people can see, as much as you can see with 1 watt illumination. But then, the houses of the ancients were much smaller too. The next lamp, there's a question, yes please.
At what point did it have such a drastic change from the
the two styles there? At what point did that occur?
That goes gradually, usually. That goes gradually. You have then mixed forms in between. But usually you have an abrupt change when an abrupt political event happens. When the Romans came into the country, then everything Roman became the in thing, everything that was before the out thing. And then you get radical changes, you see.
And does a smaller size mean less burning time?
Yes, on the whole, it does, yes. Now this, you see, would burn for at best an hour or so. Hence, of course, the five virgins were very foolish not to take along an extra supply of oil. Good. The next lamp is the only replica in the lot. It is a replica of a Jewish lamp, which is somewhat later than this Herodian lamp. You can see design-wise, they are similar. This one has a typical Jewish symbol, namely the menorah, the seven-branched candlestick. We have found, the archaeologists have found, lamps of exactly the same design, possibly the same mold with a cross on it. So you see, a pottery could oblige either produce Christian lamps or Jewish lamps. Why not? The same is true, by the way, of coffins. Then the next lamp that I would like to show you is again an original and is my most valuable piece. This is from the Byzantine period. In other words, after Christianity became first an allowed religion and then more or less the state religion with Constantine and his successors, to the time when Islam swept across the ancient world. This is so valuable because it has a cross on it, you see. It is a Byzantine lamp. And finally, let me show you the most recent one that I picked up, bought from a potter in 1959, an Arab Christian lamp. Now you see, again, design-wise, that is not all that different. It is glazed, and that's typical for Arab pottery. The earlier periods did not know glazed pottery. Furthermore, it has the fish symbol on it, and I strongly suspect that it has here the Christian meaning of the fish, you see. However, I also strongly suspect that this is produced purely for tourist pickup. Well, friends, my time is up, and I certainly do not wish to encroach on the time allotted for the next person, but you are certainly welcome to come and inspect these lamps. You may pick them up, but don't carry them out. Come back tomorrow morning. Thank you.